listener-sponsored radio in New York at 99.5 FM. We're 6.5 minutes behind schedule, and we present next Whatever Became of Carlton E. Morse. Richard Lamparski interviews the author of One Man's Family.
Do you remember what the book number and the volume number and page number was of the last episode of One Man's Family when it went off the air?
I haven't the faintest idea, but I can go out to the bookcase and get it for you.
No, it isn't necessary, but I was going to say we would make this the next one. Please, if you don't mind, we'll talk mainly about One Man's Family, because I don't think there's a single program from what we call the golden age of radio that comes up more often than One Man's Family. Even when I'm talking with people, you know, who played other characters, like Captain Midnight or Gangbusters or whatever it is, they all bring it up because it was such a distinctive program, I think, particularly at the time, because when it began was the... tell me how it came about. When did it go on the air?
Well, it went on the first April 28th, 1932. And I had been doing mystery stories and westerns and historical things in small two or three chapters. I got so sick of this chewing up the furniture and bellowing and shouting and shooting and so forth, that I sat down one day and, well, one week, and wrote three episodes, the first three episodes of One Man's Family, and submitted them to the program department. And after about a week, the program manager came back, brought them back, and gave them to me and said, we think you're written out. Why don't you forget NBC, and if anything comes along, why, we'll call you in. Well, I was horrified, and I took them to Don Gilman, who was then the West Coast Vice President of NBC, and told him what had been said to me, and asked him if he would read them and see if he thought they were of no importance to NBC. And he kept them for about 6 weeks. And finally he said, well, they're certainly different. And if I let you put them on, will you be prepared at the end of six episodes, if it doesn't go over, at the end of six episodes, you will bring it to a conclusion and we'll forget about it. And I agreed. And the following week, this show was scheduled. That was 28th of April, 1932. And the show never went off the air for almost 28 years. It was a month or two from 28 years. And so that was the beginning. And an interesting thing, you know, One Man's Family was not a plot show. It was a character show. All of the plot came out of relationship of the people in the show. And I had worked from 1929. I came to work for NBC in just the month before the crash in 1929.
Excuse me, Mr. Morris, but when you say NBC, was it NBC up here in San Francisco?
Oh, yes. We were the West Coast NBC. But NBC in those days had the Blue Network and the Red Network. And
which were you on first, One Man's Family?
Well, it was the Blue... I've forgotten now which was which, but we were on the, I think it was the Blue Network. And anyway, when NBC had to, was required to sell one of the stations in San Francisco, well, up on the Pacific Coast, I was on the network which NBC kept. And we were on the air on the Pacific Coast only for almost a year before Don Gilman took it back east and sold it to the people back there. And then we started, and we had a sponsor, No Drift and Wesson Oil was our first sponsor. And what actually sold it to the Eastern executives, the head office, was the fact that Don Gilman, we got a sponsor, a cigarette sponsor, a new cigarette, never been out before. And we'd only been on about 3 weeks when they'd completely sold out the cigarettes. They sold them one time only. And then the church people began, I've got in among my files, sermons that ministers preached against having cigarettes on one man's family. And it, the cigarette company began to be, get letters, and NBC began to get letters. They got thousands of letters protesting against this family pushing cigarettes. And before the 13 weeks, I think they were on nine weeks, when the cigarette company asked to be released from their contract, said they were doing more harm than good to their name, because people just hated it. And that stirred up such an interest in New York that Standard Brands grabbed it immediately. And we were with Standard Brands for 11 years.
Fleischmann's Yeast is...
Fleischmann's Yeast, Royal Gelatin. Oh, and we launched Tenderleaf Tea. That was our first one. We took a little tea company called Tenderleaf Tea, which Standard Brands had just bought. It was just in a New England state someplace. And in 2 years, we had made it the number two tea in the United States. Standard Brothers just loved us, and we went through all our products. We had their coffee and their from time to time, you know. In those days, fans' interest attached itself to a product because they took a show and stayed with it, so that the loyalty to a show meant loyalty to a product. And anytime you wanted the audience to make a response, if there was any talk of maybe taking a show off or changing, you would let the thing leak out to the newspapers, and the audience would begin to write letters like mad. And this was the way, you know. Not to forget the point that this was started in the Deep Depression, and this was one of the most wonderful things for radio, because people didn't have the money to go to shows, go out at night. They stayed home and listened to radio, and that was their entertainment. So all we had to do, if we could, if you get a show that the people liked, you were just on the elevator, and it grew, and radio became more important. Your show just went up with the media.
I wanted to ask you, when you were, it reminded me of a question when you were talking, Mr. Morse, about One Man's Family. What was the name of the cigarette, the brand of the cigarette?
Let me think of it for a moment.
We'll look it up. We'll look it up later.
It was a terrible thing. I think they were... Well, I shouldn't say it, because they may be still on in a small way.
Not on radio and television, they're not.
No, but I mean, I shouldn't decry their goodness or badness. What I can say was that they were waterproof cigarettes. You could smoke them in the shower or in the rain or anything of that kind. It was just as well. I was very happy when we lost.
I think that was an interesting point you made about the fact that you always thought of One Man's Family when you were writing it as being more of a character show than a plot show. Did it ever bother you? You must have heard some of the takeoffs that Bob and Ray used to do about one fellow's family.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I know those things. They never bothered me. I mean, as a matter of fact, it was, whether they knew it or not, it was a compliment. Why would they bother with it if it wasn't nationally known and would bring importance to their own listening audience? So, no, I... That was their privilege. I mean, they did it to everyone, so why should I stand out?
Coveney Morris mentioned just a moment ago that the program began during the Depression, right at the depths of the Depression. And I thought an interesting aspect of it was that the Barbers were a family, and of course there were many of them in the United States, that were probably a little less touched by the Depression because they were sort of what you would call upper middle class. He was a broker, wasn't he, Mr. Barber?
Right. That's right. That is another reason that I suspect that they wouldn't be accepted so readily today as the anti-establishment feeling that is in the country today. And yet, that is the overall picture. Both sides of it. I think the weight goes on the liberal and establishment group, especially the younger group. But there is the mere fact that you're sitting here talking to me about this now, there are still an awful lot of people in the United States that remember, in a nostalgic sense, One Man's Family, and would love to do it, and would love to hear more of it. But as you know, radio and television are for the young people. Their sponsors are more anxious to glean in these new potential users of their product, and they want to sell the young people above everybody else. The older people, that's good, but they're not spending the money that the young people are good. And also, their life span is so much shorter than the younger group that business just has to play up to them. And I don't know. They would probably be very unhappy with One Man's Family. The young people who had never heard it before, because we never had any money or social or problems with class problems or race problems. Anything like that. It was strictly within the family circle. How do young people and their parents get along with each other, and how do they parents handle their children in such a way that they are respected by the children and the children will listen to them? My personal belief is that the great problem today is that parents were not good parents to their children. They brought it down on themselves, because after you could see it, after the First World War, there were shocking things beginning to take place, and this was a long time ago. And then after the Second World War, it just seemed like parents didn't give a damn. And their parents, I think the young people, my own feeling is that the young people lack for love and have tried to find it among themselves because they just gave up the older people as possible loving characters.
I'd be interested in what you had to say about what I'm going to say, Mr. Morris. I've thought about this before, and I think that the age group that you're talking about, the people who are parents today of the kids that they feel are so unruly, were probably the most scarred generation this country has produced, because they were hit on with, most of them, with the Depression. When they were growing up, that's all they heard, that it was hard times. Even if they had money, mm-hmm. they were conscious that it was everywhere. And then the war, which broke up marriages, which kept people from getting married. And I'm not defending them, but I think they are a neurotic generation because of many things. Mm-hmm. Whereas your generation, I felt, they had much more background or substance, or their personalities developed better in some way.
Mm-hmm. I was raised on a ranch up in Southern Oregon up until I was 17 years old, and cow milking ranch. And I used to milk 10 cows night and morning. We got up at 4 o'clock and milked, and then I had to drive a horse and buggy to about a mile and a half to a railroad station to catch the milk train, and then come back and get breakfast and change my clothes and get ready for school, and then we walked to school. So that by the time 9 o'clock, I think school started at 9 o'clock in those days, I was pooped before I even started to study, and I can remember day after day of falling out of school and would be warm and falling asleep and to the drone of voices.
Well, we used to think that built character, and in a way I think it did.
Well, it got you used to doing things that had to be done. And this is so important. If you don't just lie down and say, well, we won't do anything because it's all too hard. You are taught in your mind, I mean, you want to do the right thing, and as a result, you do. I think this is the reason that I was able to write these shows for such a long time, and I was doing both. For 7 years, I was doing both I Love a Mystery, which was 5 days a week, and One Man's Family, which was a half hour once a week, which meant I could write a 15-minute show at a sitting. That meant 5 I Love a Mysteries and 2 days for One Man's Family, and I wrote 7 days a week for 7 years. And beside that, I did all the directing, casting, producing of the show. And some of the times we were doing, too, as I mentioned to you earlier, we were doing repeat shows. There was no such thing as recordings or tape or anything of that kind. So that for the East Coast, we were doing a show at 4 o'clock in the afternoon West Coast time for an 8 o'clock show in New York. And then an hour later, we were repeating the show for Chicago, the Midwest area. And then at 8 o'clock at night, we were doing the West Coast show. So by the time we were doing the West Coast, we had it pretty pat. But that is the reason having gotten up at 4 o'clock in the morning on a ranch to milk cows, it was easy enough for me to get up 4 o'clock in the morning to write a script. And it would take me about 2 hour to 2.5 hours to do a 15-minute script. And that's pretty good typing, even if you were just reading them.
They were pretty good scripts, too. Before we go on, I want to ask you, if you would, to describe where we were, where we are right now, because I'm guessing, was this the Sky Ranch? Was this the inspiration for the Sky Ranch? Tell them a little bit about where we are and how you've done it.
Well, I set the family, let me say first, I set the family home in Sea Cliff, San Francisco. I never lived there. I lived on Knob Hill all the time I was in San Francisco. And then when we got a couple of dogs in our apartment there, and they were, you know, they were great big black and white collies, and we had to get them out of there. It was just impossible to for the four of us, my wife and me, and the two collies, to live in the apartment we had. So we moved down to we got an acre down in this area, and became acquainted with it, and then we bought this property. For five, let's see, the show started in 32, and we went to Hollywood in 37, so it was 5 years. I drove back and forth between here and San Francisco every day. And when we went to Hollywood, I discovered that I could write another show, and with the energy I was wasting on traveling back and forth, and that's when I Love a Mystery came into being. I got off the track a little bit, but I had you ask me a question that I haven't answered.
No, it was interesting, though, what you said. Now, I wanted you to tell the radio audience, because they can't see our surroundings, about where this house is. We said it was the one that inspired the Sky Ranch, or the Sky Ranch inspired this house. Which came first? Did you think of the house, or did you think of the Sky Ranch?
Oh, the house. Excuse me. I didn't bring the Sky Ranch into one man's family until the family was established. It was when Claudia married Nicky, and he had a lot of money, and she had inherited some from her first husband, who was dead. So they came down and bought a horse ranch down in the peninsula, 40 miles from San Francisco, halfway between San Francisco and Santa Cruz.
WBAI, New York.
And we made this their home, the vacation area for the rest of the family. All moved in on them during the holidays, during the summertime.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the son, Jack, used to hole up here and do his writing at the Sky Ranch?
Jack?
Who was the one who wrote the books?
Oh, Paul.
Paul. Didn't he used to write? Every once in a while, he'd go out to the Sky Ranch to do some writing.
He had his studio at the top of the family home. And he would get away and come down here sometimes, but mostly he worked. He was shut off. He shut himself off from he had the whole top of the house, the third story of the house. And that's where he did most of his writing.
Whom do you hear from who are left of the cast? I understand Mother and Father Barbara died.
Yes. And Clifford died. Nicky died, and I just spent the last 2 weeks at the Bohemian Grove with Mike Raffetto, who played Paul, and he was the principal, the oldest son, and the principal character. And across the bay in Oakland, Bernice Berwin, who played Hazel in the family, the oldest daughter. Paige Gilman, down at business manager of a paper down in Watsonville, between Santa Cruz and Carmel. There's hundreds of the second and third generation youngsters down in Hollywood, because that all happened down there. But those are the basic characters that are left. Claudia, the original Claudia, married a publisher in New York and lives back there. She left the show after about 18 years. The others stayed with the show to the bitter end.
Now, I didn't hear the bitter end. I didn't hear the last broadcast. But I want to ask you, in the script, how did the twins turn out? Because as I recall, people were worried about the twins.
You're talking about Hazel's twins, Hank and Pinky. Well, Pinky was a little red-haired promoter. He was quite a promoter. And Hank became a doctor before the show came to an end. The two boys, and they started in the show when they were about 8 or 10. The last I heard of Hank, he became a fighter pilot, and he just dropped out of sight. I don't know. He may be still alive, but we never hear from him. That was Hank. Pinky joined. It was before the Peace Corps, but he was with United States diplomatic mission of some kind, and spent a number of years in the Orient. And I think he's back. I don't know what his business is now. There's so many of them. It's like your own cousins and second cousins and so forth. You're vaguely aware that they're around someplace, but you very seldom see them anymore.
Because they feel it that you work with them so long, 28 years, nearly 28 years. Did it feel like a family?
Oh, very much. Very much. As a matter of fact, Paige Gilman was an only son. And he adopted the family, to this day, and he's in his middle 50s now. And he started when he was about 10, 11 years old in the show. He still writes to members of the family as though he was one of them. I mean, they were real and true. They were to him. All of us had that feeling. As a matter of fact, they got, so almost everybody called people by their stage names. Paul and Hazel, Claudia, Clifford.
Were they very similar in some cases to the characters you wrote?
Well, I meant to tell you earlier that when I was telling you about how the show started, I worked with all these people, with the exception of Mother Barbara, Minetta Ellen. I worked with these people for 2 or 3 years, writing other shows, The Mistress and other. And I got to know that I did all my own producing and directing all the time from the beginning. So that it was very easy for me to... I got to know them so well. I knew what their good points were. I knew... what they did better than anybody else. And I wrote the characters to fit these people. I mean, I thought about them. I picked the cast before I ever wrote a line. And then I wrote for them specifically. And the way, for the first 10, 15 years, I wrote week by week. In other words, I would write a show. We go in and rehearse it and put the show on And it wasn't until after that show was over that I started the next one. We were on Sunday at that time. So Monday morning, I started out the new show full of the good things that the cast had given me in the last show. And the result was that I would give the cast something, the cast would give me something, and I'd build on that, and they would build on that. And this was the way the show grew. It grew in honesty and integrity. I mean, these were the people. And it got so that after 2 or 3 years, the cast would come in and pick up their scripts and get up in front of the microphone, immediately fall into the character, which was themselves, and do the show almost as good the first time through as it was done finally. The main thing was sound effects and timing and that sort of thing that made it necessary to have a second dress rehearsal. We do. I don't think we'd spend more than 2 hours on a show. And this, all our trouble always came with having new characters into the show, because they wouldn't fit in as easily, and it would take more time with them.
Would you tell me, Mr. Morris, as a final question, about the last broadcast, how you felt about it, how you feel the cast felt about it?
I got beautiful letters from every member of the cast. It was as though something had died for them. Unfortunately, or fortunately for me, we were doing One Man's Family on television in New York. At the same time we were doing it in radio out here, we had a New York cast for the television and the radio, old radio cast out here on the coast, and I wasn't here when the show ended. The show was still alive as far as I was concerned, because I was back there writing the show. I was so tired by that time, and we'd done it so long that it just seemed like a chance for a little freedom, that I could do some of the things I wanted to do earlier, which was I wanted to write something for the eye. I wanted to write a book. And I never have stopped writing, and I never will stop writing, and it's my own satisfaction. I don't even need audience approval anymore.
I thought you were going to be very reluctant about getting me an interview. You said you were just terrible interviews. We've talked all over one tape, and we're into another. Can I talk to you some time about I Love a Mystery?
Well, certainly. Are you out here generally? Do you make trips out here from the East regularly? Good. We'll come back and we'll talk about I Love a Mystery.
That was actually my favorite, even more than One Man's Family. I've been talking today with Mr. Carlton E. Morris in his house. This is Woodside, California. We call it the Sky Ranch. Broadcasting from the Sky Ranch, surrounded in California Redwoods. And I want to thank him very much, a particular personal thanks, because I liked the program so much. And I knew so many people of an older generation who were very sad, unlike you, when it went off the air. Anyway, I want to thank you very much, and thank you for listening. This is Richard Lamparski at the Sky Ranch. I hope you all have a real good evening.